The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, human rights violations in the war on drugs. The NGO No Peace Without Justice held a panel discussion recently entitled Accountability for Human Rights Violations Committed in the Name of the War on Drugs to examine accountability mechanisms by linking the ongoing prosecution of former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte at the International Criminal Court with recent U.S. military strikes on ostensibly civilian vessels in the Caribbean. The event was held September 30th as a side event at the 60th session of the UN's Human Rights Council. It explored how international law can protect both direct victims and populations in whose name such violence occurs. We'll hear portions of that event on today's show. But first, loyal listeners will recall that I live in Portland, Oregon. Portland's a beautiful city. Oregon's a wonderful state. I am so glad to live here. It's truly a blessing. My city's been in the news recently because the Trump regime decided to send in federal troops in a failed attempt to frighten locals and to intimidate our federal, state, and local representatives. I'm not a huge fan of any elected officials, generally. I mean, some are better than others, much better in some cases, and some are just awful. The point is, at some level, all politicians have flaws. Now, having said that, some of them do get some really great work done. And not to brag, but I've had the great good fortune to live in districts represented by some of those good ones. Representative Earl Blumenauer, for example, was a strong leader in the House for marijuana legalization and drug policy reform, among other issues, until his recent retirement. Loyal listeners will recall that he granted me a handful of interviews over the years. Earl represented District 3 in Oregon, which is basically Portland and some of the surrounding metro area. Prior to becoming a member of Congress, Earl had been a Portland City Councilor. He was elected to the House in a special election in May of 96 to finish the term of Ron Wyden, who got elected to the Senate in January of 1996 in another special election, in this case caused by the resignation of disgraced Senator Bob Packwood. Wyden had been a member of Congress since 1981, representing District 3, which again is Portland and some of the surrounding metro area. Senator Wyden is still in office. He currently serves on the Senate Finance Committee. In addition to his important work on marijuana legalization, Senator Wyden has been a leader on another issue of great concern, the investigation into Jeffrey Epstein, the late sex trafficker and pedophile, and into the financial and personal networks that supported Epstein. On July 31st, Senator Wyden posted a summary of his staff's investigation to date. Let's listen.
There is no question in my mind that Jeffrey Epstein took advantage of loopholes in the law to exploit women, particularly the loophole that allows the banks to get away with looking the other way when someone like Epstein is engaging in these vile practices. My team saw firsthand the names of women and young girls in these documents. And from an investigation standpoint, that's a big tell. I'm Ron Wyden, one of Oregon's United States senators, and I'm the ranking Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee. And we decided that this was very much in our brand of saying we'll do investigations where we follow the money. With our investigations, we have a paper trail. The only people who've seen it thus far are the bipartisan staff of the Senate Finance Committee. We started looking more than 3 years ago. We were very interested, of course, in the banks because the banks have special rules, federal rules, that they are supposed to step up and protect the public when there are serious problems. And we have accounts, we have federal files, and we can look into areas that nobody has ever really thought of. I started from the proposition, doesn't get any more serious in terms of a really god-awful offense than sex trafficking. And everywhere we turned around, we would see very affluent people. And of course, it seems that much of it started in Palm Beach and New York and a handful of neighbors where people talk. In the case of Mr. Leon Black, for example, one of the settlements really in effect says that some of the money that Mr. Black made available to Mr. Epstein was used for sex trafficking. So we followed the money. We went to the Treasury Department. We looked at suspicious activity reports, what are called SARs. We made it bipartisan. You know, we worked on this early on with Republicans. And the more we saw, the more concerned I was. And that's why most recently we made clear that we were talking about well over 4,000 wire transfers. I knew that there'd be a lot of wire activity trying to get so much money around the world for Epstein's sex trafficking, but I never expected 4,000 wire transfers through one bank. Is $1 billion in total. We showed that this was not a kind of flashy one-off, and we assume that much of what is in those wire transfers, the details, involves activity in sex trafficking. This investigation has taken more than 3 years, and we went to the Treasury Department and looked at the documents with the Biden staff in February of 2024. The reason this is different than during the Biden times is we have much more information. We were just in the information gathering period during the Biden administration. This was building step by step by step, collecting the evidence, examining it, making sure we knew where it was and how you would access it. And we continued to collect more information. And when we felt that it was time to respond and to particularly get the Trump people moving on an investigation, we did. Donald Trump has made some far-fetched statements over the last few months. But a stunner in the last few days was his claim that the Jeffrey Epstein matter was a hoax and a scam. I went to the floor of the United States Senate, and then I told the American people as it became clear that Donald Trump would not. It is absolutely ludicrous for Pam Bondi to say that there is nothing to investigate. 4,000 wire transfers, that is a heck of a lot of lines for possible investigation. But Trump's DOJ had no interest in spending a significant amount of time looking at those files at the Treasury Department. They didn't go to Treasury because they didn't want to face the facts. Donald Trump was president through all of this. Donald Trump knew Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein died in a federal prison under Donald Trump's watch. Now his attorney general is saying there's nothing to investigate. Pardon me. I continue to be very concerned about Epstein having used sanctioned Russian banks to basically spread money from sex trafficking all around the world. The next step is for the Treasury Department to make available on a bipartisan basis to the Senate Finance Committee the documents we've asked for. My own judgment is if Pam Bondi wanted to get up in the next morning or two and make these documents available to the Senate Finance Committee, she could do it. One of the most important questions that comes out of this is why were America's leading banks, a number of them, basically sleepwalking through this whole Epstein matter? They should have been watchdogging this. They should have brought to law enforcement what they believe was going on. One of the key changes I'm going to push for is writing new black letter law that makes sure that there will be civil and criminal sanctions when banks see this sort of activity and they look the other way. I've come to feel that there's some issues that aren't considered blue or red. That's the case with sex trafficking. People believe it's just plain wrong. They understand that women and young girls are getting hurt, and they want to know what happened, and they want the answers.
That was Senator Ron Wyden providing a full breakdown of his ongoing Follow the Money investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. That audio and accompanying video were posted July 31st to Senator Wyden's Facebook page. Senator Wyden's investigation continues. Now, this is not a topic we usually cover on this show, and I thank you, dear listener, for allowing me this personal indulgence. It's an important topic, and it also provides context for other events that you've been hearing about. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now turning to our top story. The global drug war has become a pretext for systematic human rights violations and state violence, including extrajudicial executions, torture, arbitrary detention, and crimes against humanity. The NGO No Peace Without Justice held a panel discussion recently entitled Accountability for Human Rights Violations Committed in the Name of the War on Drugs as a side event at the 60th session of the UN's Human Rights Council to examine accountability mechanisms by linking the ongoing ICC prosecution of former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte with recent U.S. military strikes on ostensibly civilian vessels in the Caribbean. The event explored how international law can protect both direct victims and the populations in whose name such violence occurs. Let's hear part of that discussion. We start our coverage with opening remarks by Niccolo Figa-Talamanca, Secretary General of No Peace Without Justice. He introduces the first speaker, Gilbert Andre, lawyer for victims of Duterte's war on drugs and executive director of the Center for International Law.
My name is Niccolo Figa-Talamanca. I'm the Secretary General of No Peace Without Justice. And I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to moderate a panel discussion with experts, both from the Philippines and from the United States, to discuss how the global push to combat narcotics has become an occasion and a pretext for systematic human rights violations and state violence, including extrajudicial executions, torture, arbitrary detention, and crimes against humanity. In this side event, we link the ongoing ICC investigation and prosecution of former president of the Philippines, President Rodrigo Duterte, with the recent U.S. military strikes on ostensibly civilian vessels in the Caribbean, exploring how international law can and does protect direct victims of those crimes, and also we will look at the political dynamics that lead to state violence, including extrajudicial executions, but not only. I think the case of the Philippines provides a useful cautionary tale on how political wind can change and what can be appear as something which is politically useful and interesting from the point of view of gaining popular support can and does sometimes result in possible accountability. I will start the first round of questions, and in particular, I will ask here my dear colleague and friend, Gilbert Andreas, who's the lawyer for the victims. What is the impact of the war on drugs on the victim? What has been the impact in the Philippines? Is it over in any way? And what was the scale of the problem in the Philippines? So that we frame the issue also in terms of the level of intensity on the civilian population of the Philippines. Gilbert, you have.
Thank you, Niccolo, and also good afternoon to our colleagues. It's called the War on Drugs by the Duterte administration from 2016 to 2022, but it's actually the War on the Poor. Why? It's really the low-income, high-density communities that were targeted In fact, this can be confirmed if you look at the numerous reports that have been published by CSOs. Who are these low-income communities? Just to give you an idea, this table over here, this is already the size, the area of their homes, of their houses. One block composed of 10,000 people. So that's how high-density, low-income communities were targeted by the Duterte war on drugs. And just to humanize it, one of our clients, his son was just murdered by a police operation. And the mother herself was detained based on false drug charges. And the partner, who's actually pregnant, was detained together with the mother of the murdered son. This was also the modus operandi so that the family members will not file criminal complaints. In fact, when we visited the mother, he was literally just shaking out of the very fresh trauma he experienced and is still experiencing. In fact, he was released after months, and I think it took a year or 2 years before she was released on Trump up charges. So these are actually the communities that were affected. In fact, in one of the client communities that we have helped, there was a point that in 2016, I think from November or to December of 2016, they just left their homes. Why? And they just went to the market, the public market, just to live there so that if they will be murdered, it will be public. Because they really felt the Oplan Tokhang operations against them. So CSO estimates have been 15,000 to 30,000. In fact, this has been cited in the Office of the Prosecutor request for investigation filed last May 2021. And the police, the Philippine National Police itself admitted that at least 6,000 people were killed during official police drug operations. So what were the other effects? So there were the murdered family members. There were also the secondary effects such as arbitrary detentions of family members just to unduly influence them not to file criminal complaints. And this was in the hundreds of thousands. In fact, there are estimates that at least 300,000 were victims of illegal arbitrary detentions. Third, there were also stigmatization in their local communities, in their barangays, to the point some of them just left their barangays because the stigma of being a family member of a war on drug victims stayed with them in their barangay. Fourth, there was also economic, psychosocial dislocation because the target of the war on drugs were men of breadwinning capacities and they were murdered. And there was really dislocation economically because the children still have to have food on the table as well as education. And yet because of the war on drugs, they just left their barangays. So this is essentially a war on the poor. And it's unfortunate that this happened in the Philippines. And the victims say this should not happen again in any region of the world.
That was Gilbert Andre, lawyer for victims of Duterte's war on drugs and executive director of the Center for International Law. You also heard Nicolo Figa Talamanca, Secretary General of No Peace Without Justice. They spoke September 30th at a panel discussion organized by No Peace Without Justice entitled Accountability for Human Rights Violations Committed in the Name of the War on Drugs, which was held as a side event at the 60th session of the UN Human Rights Council. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear more. This next segment features Dave Borden, Executive Director of StopTheDrugWar.org and the DRC Net Foundation. The next voice you hear will be that of Nicolo Figa Talamanca, Secretary General of No Peace Without Justice.
David Borden, I mentioned, is the executive director of an organization focusing historically on the war on drugs, the DRC Net Foundation. David, you've been following, obviously, the Philippines case and the war on drugs since 2017. Particularly, you've been working also side by side at the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs and other international meetings. Now, other than the Philippines, is the Philippines an isolated case where extrajudicial killings and other violations are committed deliberately and expressly for political gain under the banner of the war on drugs? I think...
Well, the Philippines is the largest and most well-known example. Unfortunately, it's not an isolated example. It was preceded in maybe 2006 by 3,000 killings in the drug war in Thailand under called for by the former prime minister, who just returned from exile, Shinawatra Thaksin. It was followed in close succession by killings numbering in the hundreds in both Indonesia and Bangladesh as well. And it could be argued that this happened in Brazil, although not distinctly from other types of police killings and not identified or called for as such, other than one campaign comment I recall from Bolsonaro.
Thank you, David. Hopefully that won't happen in Indonesia again, but we've heard the current president floating perhaps a trial balloon to see whether what they call a tough approach on crime, which is actually a tough approach on the victims of the trade of narcotics, floating the idea that the war on drugs could turn again into a killing field. You mentioned those countries in Asia, but you in the United States the White House reported the support by President Trump in his first administration for the policies of Duterte and praise of the Duterte anti-drug program. Is that something that that should be of concern? And is that something that you think could potentially encourage others, including Widodo, in that direction?
I am worried about this, and we've warned on our email list to our membership at least since February that we should be concerned about the possibility that Trump could attempt Duterte-style drug war killings here in the U.S. Now, saying that's a possibility is not the same as saying it's likely. It's not something he campaigned on. It's not something I see a lot of people calling for here. But with what's happened in the Caribbean, and particularly how the president and his officials who were involved in the boat strikes have found support from some quarters for this, elements of the right that I wish I could say were fringe, but have mainstream platforms on outlets like CNN, I don't think we can rule it out. It seems more likely now than it did 2 weeks ago. And we have some real risk factors. We've seen increased aggressiveness and abusiveness by police in the U.S. in the context of ramped up immigration enforcement, Trump's attempt to do mass deportations, the number of immigration and customs enforcement, ICE agents, is, I think, maybe set to double under funding that Trump obtained from the Republican majority in its budget. That kind of expansion that quickly would be fraught with peril at the best of times. We're not in the best of times. The normalization of violence on the right, and you know, let me say for U.S. audiences, you know, violence is not exclusive to one political side, as we've seen. There is a particular systemic problem on the right in recent times. We've seen disturbing trends. There was a young man named Kyle Rittenhouse. This was during the height of the pandemic, when there were large-scale Black Lives Matter protests in the cities. He traveled from out of state with his weapons, picked a fight with two protesters, then shot and killed them, was acquitted of the murders, and was lionized on the political right. Another warning sign is Trump's own popularity. Disapproval has been mounting, even among some of his supporters of extreme policies. And if come fall of next year or fall of 2028, he's feeling like he might lose the election. We don't know what he's capable of, what he might try. You know, the trial balloon floated by the current Indonesian president in the height of protests against him. Maybe Trump will attempt a trial balloon, see if the drug war can resonate for him here in a different way. And we know what he's said about extrajudicial drug war killings. We know what he's done now. Things are... lots of things are happening here that are changing things. So we should be concerned, and we should prepare in whatever ways we can to push back.
That was Dave Borden, Executive Director of StopTheDrugWar.org and the DRC Net Foundation. In that segment, you also heard Niccolò Figa-Talamanca, Secretary General of No Peace Without Justice. They spoke September 30th at a panel discussion organized by No Peace Without Justice entitled Accountability for Human Rights Violations Committed in the Name of the War on Drugs, which was held as a side event at the 60th session of the UN Human Rights Council. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support public media and local community radio. Become members. Become volunteers. In a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh.
For the Drug Truth
so
Network,
long.
This is
so
Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.